are interesting are people who are interested. Any person, for example, who is constantly thinking about all sorts of other things and other people and so on, because they're fascinating, becomes a fascinating person. So in other words, your engagement with the external world, the more you are involved, the more your personality is enriched.
Hello, listener, and welcome to a long overdue new episode of this podcast. Life has been pretty busy, so it just kind of fell off the side. That was until I read the book of today's guest, after which I thought I just have to make a podcast with this guy. In the show, we discuss the much-contested optimal diet for humans, what are some of the long-tail effects of consistently eating the wrong things for our bodies, how men can grow breasts, how a water fast allows the body to successfully detox, and how the human brain is getting smaller and less glorious than it once was. I have to say, Dow's arguments are pretty rock solid, and I'm so convinced that I'm personally now planning to do a week-long water fast and then experimenting with a raw food diet. If you meet him in the flesh, you'll actually see that he's about twice as nimble as men half his age, so he's a pretty good advert for his methods. I'm recording this around Christmas time, just as everyone will be retoxing like heroes. So who knows, maybe the timing is pretty good to get a few more people on the New Year detox bandwagon. Enjoy the show. So my guest today is the author of the book, What on Earth is Food? Nature versus the Modern Diet. The book is super interesting and a real eye-opener for anyone looking to reach optimal health in their body and mind through diet. He's been running detox retreats for 20 years, which means he definitely knows his stuff. I've met him a few times and he's an undeniable picture of health. He practices what he preaches and is without doubt worth listening to. He's the mind, body, nutritional and scientific master, Dow Earl. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for that wonderful intro. Makes me feel all grandiose and masterful, which I dislike.
It's all right. It'd be rude not to give you at least some grandiose introduction. So I do want to dive into your detox and your book, but before we get to that, can we give the listener a little bit of history about how you came to become fascinated with this field and what's your personal story?
Sure, yeah. It was a while back. I've been bouncing around with this subject for 25, 30 years. And it started for me when I found myself in Thailand for years on end, having smoked myself sick of cannabis and wanting something else, but not knowing what it was. And I went to Taiwan actually to earn some money. This is way, way back. This is in the 80s when it was possible to earn money teaching English and all that kind of business. And I went there and started to study Tai Chi and Qigong and things like that. It led me down the path to Chinese medicine. And I was just looking for something. I had no idea what I was even interested in at that point. But it appealed to my detailed nature, the whole Chinese medical field. But I quickly came to understand that to understand anything through that lens, you've got to be able to understand everything through that lens. And it's a big subject with lots and lots of nuances to it. And at the time that I became disenchanted with Chinese medicine, I was handed a book called The Tao of Health, Sex and Longevity, which has started to make its way around again. And it tackles many things. Essentially, it's trying to weave together Daniel Reed's understanding of Chinese medicine in with modern health practices. And he talks about raw food in there. He talks about colonics in there. He talks about fasting in there. And that just sent me off with the help of a couple of other nerds that I was in contact with at the time. Sent me off on a journey of discovery around that. And it's just stunning that of all of the kind of what would you call that, the sort of edifice of Chinese medicine, of all of this complex, nuanced interrelationship of every single thing that you need to understand in order to understand anything else in that web, all just fell away into the simplicity of just eat what nature built us to eat. No faff, no complication, no mind, no intellect. Just look at what has worked for billions of years already. Duh. And that was the tipping point for me. And that is all easy to say at one level. And of course, you do have to get involved a little bit in the nuances of a different kind of language, a different kind of map that we are familiar with. So the language of biology and the language of cells and tissues and hormones and all that kind of stuff, because people are in very strange places in their health. And so to unpick what's going on with that for the entertainment of the mind, really, to give people a sense of direction back towards better health, you do have to engage with that sort of complex language. But it's not essential to the understanding. The understanding is we evolved eating certain things, eat them and certain things work. Stop eating them and eat other things and some things won't work anymore. It's obvious. You put diesel in your petrol car, yes, it will go, but it will smoke and the wheels will fall off and it won't have a very long life. It's like that kind of understanding. But the thing that gives me conviction, aside from all of that, aside from the seeming simplicity of it, aside from the obviousness of it, the thing that gives me conviction in it is about 5 or 6 years after I started getting involved in this stuff for myself. So almost eating entirely raw, which I did for the first 10 years. It's not what I advocate these days because most people can't get there. And it's not what I do because I live in a little 3-bedroom house with 6 people and 2 teenagers and, you know, life goes on. But as an ideal, as an understanding, that's the direction. But the thing that gives me conviction in it is after 4 or 5 years of achieving that, a long time ago, certain things changed in my body that I've never heard any other medical school talk about. I've never heard anybody out there, whether from the pharmaceutical world, from the herbological world, from Chinese medicine, from Ayurveda, from any of them, talk about really fundamental things like why the human being has to wash its skin. No one even talks about that. Why the human being doesn't really have an immune system anymore. You get a cut, you have to take care of it, you have to keep it clean, you have to mamby-pamby to it. No other animal on the planet has to do anything like that.
Yeah, we have to filter our water.
Yeah, exactly. Why we have to have clean water when every other animal can drink out of a puddle. These things talk about a massive train crash that's gone on in our health that we just don't look at. Because it's normal for everybody, but it's not normal for any other animal on the planet. And if you compare human beings to all the other animals on the planet, we're in a very different place, and that needs to be understood. But the thing that gives me conviction to this argument is all of that started to change for me. I've never since had a skin infection. I don't wash my body anymore. I don't wash my hair anymore for 30 years. And so the body doesn't smell. The body doesn't stink. The body doesn't get infected. It's just like fundamental differences that no other medical system even asks the question about, let alone gives the answer.
Okay, I'm super interested now because I've spent good time in your company in the past, and I can definitely vouch that Dao does not have a BO problem. So I'm quite entertained to find out that you haven't washed for that long. Very, very fascinating. So at what point in this, because I've been on some sort of, like most people, and I think, you know, probably anybody listening to this knows somebody that's sick in some way in a digestive manner. And I see it's like an absolute pandemic of people eating supermarket foods that have this in, that have that in. It's mass agro. Not everybody can afford organic food, blah, blah, blah. The story goes on. But it's, you know, every second person seems to have Crohn's or colitis or irritable bowel syndrome. You know, something quite massive is happening to so many people. So I've been on a bit of a journey similar. I mean, nothing like that maybe is extreme. But I'm intrigued when you said 4 or 5 years in is when you had the conviction. What was the You know, did you just, you cut yourself and it healed within a day, or you were able to drink pond water? Well, yeah, what was this like mad turning point?
Well, like I said, I was living in Asia, and periodically I would come back to England to see the folks and to do some work here. And each year when I came back, you know, I would come back with the usual sort of litany of mosquito bites and cuts and grazes that become infected and become these tropical ulcers. And it's not a problem because I'm going back to England soon. I'll just get a course of antibiotics when I'm back there and they'll all heal up. And, you know, the usual story, the kind of, you know, the traveler's woes coming back to England, to the land of plenty and normality, and they all heal up and go away because it's so wet in the forest and it's damp and things don't heal, all that blah. That's not true of all the other animals there, duh. But these are the lines that we wheel out to protect our fragility. And one year I was still, you know, mosquito bites and sore cuts because I was living up in the forest, rebuilding my bungalow every 5 minutes when the forest tries to reclaim it. There's all kinds of scratches and splinters and, you know, bites and things. And I came back to England and suddenly realised, oh, these haven't become tropical ulcers. What's going on? Something is different. They were, you know, still getting cuts and scratches and mosquito bites and all the rest of it, but they weren't big necrotic things burrowing into my flesh suddenly that I needed antibiotics for. And it's been like that ever since. If I get a splinter or a cut or, you know, a big graze or anything, it heals. It's not like it heals in 5 minutes. It's not like some sort of, you know, X-Men sort of vision. It's that it doesn't get infected. It heals up of its own accord in the next couple of days. It doesn't need plasters. It doesn't need bandages. It doesn't need iodine. And, you know, it just does its thing like it does on every other animal. So that's what I'm trying to point to. Not that there's something special about me at all. It's the point is there's this underlying state of health that is completely obscured by all kinds of other things that we do that obscure it. And so the obvious ones are eating the wrong foods and la, 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 la. But it's a very old story.
You reckon you say maybe 4 or 5 years of eating raw, being a raw vegan?
I can only say that that's how it happened to me.
Okay.
There's no prescription in there. There's only a story.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like us to go into a little bit of detail about what is creating the sickness generally, and you've simplified it, which gives us the great start point because it's just eat what you were designed to eat, basically. But on a more like biological level and a gut bacteria level, I'd like to get your thoughts on that, because essentially there seems to be there's lots of complex things going in the gut, absolutely, undoubtedly. But you seem to digest it down into two things, which is lactobacteria, which provide nutritional benefit. And then you just put other bacteria, which putrefy and create toxins. And that's pretty much, you just seem to put it in two camps. But can you expand on that?
Yeah, it's a universe of story going on in our gut. And the reason that I simplify it into those categories is that you can forever go into details of each individual microbe living in there and what it needs and who it relates to and what it does for the body and la, 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 la. And you can go into that endlessly. And the point for me is not what all of the little individual players do. It's not what each of the instruments in the orchestra are playing. It's what the orchestra is doing. That's the effect. And so we have an attitude around microbes in the past 10 years, which has changed, because in the past 100 years before that, it was all no, microbes are bad, bacteria cause disease. And suddenly all that's had to shift. And we are now into an age where we're starting to understand that there are some microbes that are good for us. There are some bacteria that are useful to us. And so the age of probiotics and fermented foods has arrived. And it's been around for a long time. The oldest medicines written in Europe, for example, are all ferments, because they knew that the problem starts in the gut. And if you don't fix it in the gut, then it just migrates throughout the rest of the body. But they were missing a piece of the jigsaw for the same reason that we're still missing a piece of the jigsaw. So to understand this, you need to look with a much longer view, that there are microbes that live inside us that feed us, that we have to feed for them to feed us. And these are microbes that have been inside mammals for as long as there have been mammals, and probably longer. And so we have a relationship with those certain types of microbes. We don't invent them. They come in on the food that we eat, and they find a beneficial environment inside us because we are feeding them. And those are in turn feeding us. At the same time, we are also inviting into the gut a whole host of other bacteria that we are then feeding if they like the food that we're eating. But they don't necessarily feed us because we haven't had a 2 billion year relationship with them. We haven't learned how to make use of their waste products, but we still have to process their waste products. And that's the definition of a toxin, that which the body is forced to process but cannot make use of. And so the difference is we feed both of them, but some of them feed us back and others don't feed us back. That's why they're either useful bacteria or they're not useful bacteria. So I use a few sort of commonly understood words in the lectures that I give to give people something to hook onto. So I use the word lactobacteria, because that's a whole class of bacteria that people have heard of and associate with the gut. But there's many, 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 many. It's a much more broader subject than that, really. So there's these ones that feed us and there's these ones that don't feed us. So if we're looking at what the human being was supposed to eat, then this tells us something, because we're supposed to be entirely populated, like all the other animals, entirely populated by bacteria that feeds us, that feeds from what we feed it. We feed them, they feed us. That's how it works in all mammals, actually in all animals. Only the human being has a massive population inside it of bacteria that we feed that doesn't feed us. You could say it does feed us. It feeds us toxins. It feeds us things we have to deal with but cannot make use of. So you could say it like that. But the point is, looking at what microbes feed us tells us what our original diet looked like, because they're the ones that have been inside us for the longest. If you track human beings back through history, through evolution, there's a point at which we're no longer human beings. And all of these excuses that we hide behind the word human being, like having to wash our skin, having to clean our teeth, having toxic waste inside us, having a gut full of bacteria that doesn't work for us, all of those things, they fade away as you go back in time. So there was a point at which we started to have these problems. And so if we look at the time before then, we find that the gut was full of microbes that feed us, like it is in a chimpanzee, like it is in a wolf, like it is in a badger. The gut is full of microbes that feed it because they are feeding the bacteria. And so the bacteria feeds the body. So that's all well and good. That's worked for a couple of hundred million years. It's pretty time tested, in my opinion. And then suddenly you start feeding a particular creature, human being in this case, you start feeding that completely different foods. And so completely different bacteria starts to be able to exist in the gut, completely new to the situation. Suddenly you start eating loads of grains and beans, for example, they're the obvious candidates, completely different foodstuff from vegetable matter and fruit that was being eaten before. Very dense, long chains of carbohydrates that need to be broken down in order to be digested. And so there are bacteria, the bacteria that is currently available in us can't do that. But there's other bacteria that's going to come in on that food that would love that environment, would love those foods. And so, boom, suddenly you've got a whole new population of bacteria existing in the gut, chowing down on these starchy, dense, proteiny foods that we've suddenly started eating. And they're having a lovely time. They're massively proliferating and regenerating themselves and eating all this food that they're being fed. And their metabolic byproducts, we can't make use of because we've only had a relationship with these bacteria for 10,000 years. So we have a lot of toxins floating around in the system. When you have a lot of toxins floating around in the system, then the body's got to get rid of them. So the gut is, it's already happening in the gut. The gut will try to get rid of them as much as possible, but they will migrate out into the rest of the body, and then the rest of the body has got to deal with them. So then you get the slowing down of everything. Everything becomes congested and toxic. The skin tries to get rid of these toxins, so the animal starts to stink. The lungs, the pH value of the lungs start to change. So then you get different microbes can live in the lungs. Then you start to get sicknesses in the lungs, and it goes on and on and on and on and on. But take away that main offending food source that can no longer feed that bacteria. Take the food away, the bacteria starts to die away. The rest of the bacteria will inhabit the space, continuing to eat the things that we were originally eating. And all of those toxins disappear, and all of the symptoms disappear. It's a really simple principle.
Makes perfect sense. And
simple.
It's almost too simple. So essentially, if you were just, I mean, what do you consider? Because I would say, if you're going to follow, well, okay, let's go back a little bit, because if you really want to follow exactly what we should have been eating, and all these go back hundreds of thousands of years, it's basically what chimpanzees live on, which is fruit. And I know in your book, you just hammer the fruit message constantly, which is music to my ears, because I've been sort of, when I had a few problems, digestive problems, I did a 30-day fruit only fast. And I was in Canary Wharf at the time, in London, in a high rise office block. And people thought I was insane. People thought I was going to die if I did that, you know. I say at the end of that 30 days, I probably wasn't that healthy. I wouldn't say, you know, I definitely lacked some oils. I was looking a bit old and my skin was dry, and there's definitely things missing in there. So that fruit, we know, great, brilliant. You probably can't eat too much fruit. That's no question about it. The genus that we come from, Australopithecus, was the sort of the stepping stone, and, you know, widely considered that this was the ape that ate roots and chewed all day and widened the face and learned to survive when fruit became a little bit more sparse. Hence, we're good at doing root vegetables. Outside of that, in your raw food world diet, you know, what do you allow in? Grains are a no. Beans are a no, because you can't eat them from the floor. What else falls into the no category that people might consider healthy? Because I'd say beans particularly people might think are healthy. I mean, a good example is you ruined hummus for me. I mean, because I used to absolutely love hummus, make my own hummus all the time. And then you're like, shouldn't be eating that. You know, you just think about it. If you found the bean in nature, would you be able to do it without lots of processing? And I thought, no, you wouldn't be able to do that. And so, ergo, you ruined that. But, you know, could you say the same for an olive? You know, an olive is not an olive is like a piece of rock when you find it in nature. You wouldn't necessarily eat that. But, you know, how many other things fall into the good, bad category or, you know, as best possible?
Well, you've opened the field up there. Let me address your points point by point, because there's a lot to be said. There's a big difference often between our ideas of what we would have been eating based upon our ideas of what we see, you know, a zoo exhibit chimpanzee eating, and what they actually eat in nature. So we associate monkeys with bananas, we associate, you know, certain things with certain things, but it's not actually as clear cut as that. If we look at our closest relatives, which are bonobo chimpanzees, which are different from standard chimpanzees. They're actually unrelated they're very distantly related on the scale of things, but we have a common similar name for them. And if we look at our closest version of those, we do have a lot of fruit in their diet. There are five great apes that still exist. There's lowland chimpanzees, there's gorillas, orangutans, bonobos, and human beings. If we look at that branch of the tree, if you like, then we see some interesting things. If you go from chimpanzee to gorilla to orangutan to bonobo to human being, you're going up a scale of brain size, which of course we're very keen to emphasize because we've got the biggest one and therefore we like to sell ourselves on that. But if you look at the diet of all of those creatures and you look at the relative teeth structure of all of those creatures and the dexterity in their hands and their color vision and the shape of their gut, you also find that the amount of fruit in their diet goes up as you go from chimpanzee to gorilla to orangutan to bonobo to human beings. And so it's true, there would have been a would seem to be a going by that historical record written into the structure of the body, it does seem that we would have been eating the most fruit of all of those. But our closest relative, the bonobo, doesn't eat solely fruit. They eat a large proportion of fruit, but they also eat a hell of a lot of leaves. In fact, it's different research on it, but some of the researchers are talking about around 50% leaves. So that's a lot of vegetable matter rather than fruit. And they do also eat some animal matter. So the old idea of the vegan ape, that was an idea from the 70s and the 80s that has long gone, long been washed away. All the great apes have been seen to eat some animal matter. When you talk about chimpanzees, they actively go out and hunt as a troop. Gorillas, orangutans and bonobos don't go out and hunt, but they do eat fallen animals that they've come across. They do seek out insects in the fruit that they eat. They seek out the worms in the fruit that they eat. They overturn leaves looking for snails. You know, they eat some animal matter. So it's a pretty big proportion of fruit, but it's actually a dominance of vegetable matter and some animal matter. And with that animal matter, it's going to be relatively low protein in terms of what we think is necessary for protein intake and all of that blah blah, which has zero interest for anybody that's actually looking at health. We don't even have taste buds that guide us to proteiny foods. That tells us how unimportant proteins are as a food source. But the point I'm making is that they would have had some dense protein from the animal matter, but they would have had more dense fats from the animal matter that they were eating. And it's interesting that you pointed out after your while on fruit that the thing that you felt you were looking for was fats. And fats are fundamentally essential. We can tell this not only from looking at our closest relatives, but looking at all life. In all animal life, it all seeks out certain foods and certain nutrients, I should say. And the mix of different nutrients is determined by the history of that creature. So an antelope isn't looking for sweet things. It's not looking for meat because its evolution has taught it to get everything that it needs from the grasses that it eats. And so it has a gut shape that's designed to do that. You transpose that onto the lion that's hunting it, and it's looking for very different things. It's still not looking for sweet things. It's looking for meat. It can't eat the grasses. It doesn't have a gut for it. And so it is looking to eat the antelope so that the antelope will provide it with what it needs. So it's got a digestive system that's designed to work with lots of dense proteins and lots of dense fats from the meat that it's eating. If you come to another relatively close relative of those creatures, if you look at the great apes, then you have a very different gut structure. Again, we see an animal that is looking for sweet things, is looking for fatty things, and it's looking for salty things. So our primary tastes drive us towards certain foods, and that tells us what we are looking for. If you think that, most people would term it as a sugar addiction, or they're weak-willed, or they've got something wrong with them that they need to be eating this food, or they've got some candida story, or blah, 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 blah. Fundamentally, underneath all of that is the reality that we come from a line of tropical arboreal primates. We were born, as all of those five great apes are, with some of the biggest brains in the whole of evolution. And the brain happens to be the most sugar-hungry object on the planet. And it evolved in the most sugar-rich environment on the planet, the tropical forests, seasonless, year-round, sweet fruit forests. Doesn't happen anywhere else on the planet that it happens seasonless. It's constant. And in that environment, you happen to get the single most sugar-hungry object on land in our heads. That's not a coincidence. The most sugar-hungry object built in the most sugar-rich environment. You can't. Why are we looking for other reasons that we've got a big brain? It just doesn't make any sense. Oh, we came down out of the trees, ended up on the prairies, and there we had to build a big brain out to coordinate and create language and hunt. Okay, so where did we get a big brain then? How did we run it? We need masses and masses of sugars to run this thing. You don't need dense proteins to build a brain. The brain is built from fats, not proteins, and it's run on sugars, not starches. It just doesn't make any sense. Whereas in the tropical forests, where you get all the other big-brained primates that all grew up in the same place for the same reasons, you have all the equipment you need. You've got masses of sugars, you've got masses of fats, you've got masses of everything that you need to build the most complex object on the planet in our heads. And so you take it out of the forests and run it on starches and fats, then for straight away the gut's going to go wrong because the gut wasn't designed to eat those things, and then it's not going to fuel everything else very well. And so you end up in a situation where nothing works very well.
So there's a couple of things I want to unpack there. The first thing is the protein problem, because there is this permeates. It's in my brain from youth people constantly talking about how important protein was for health, all these things. And it's essentially a myth. And I'm sure you have the wherewithal to unpack why it's a myth better than I do. And then the other thing I'd like to go over is actually let's do the protein thing first, and then how's that come about? And then let's go back to the sugary brain, and then I'll carry on from there.
Well, this word protein, it's an old term. It kind of means that it's a Greek term. It kind of means the smallest building block, and it comes from a time when our nutritional understanding was that defined, was the level of resolution that we had come to understand around nutrition was that a protein was the smallest thing, much like an atom was considered the smallest thing in physics for a long time. And then, you know, technology moves on and we realize that you can split an atom and you find that there's more sort of atomy sort of things inside them, and you split them and there's more atomy sort of things inside them. And so proteins were this kind of foundational block, that these are the bricks that you build cells from. And so at that level, it makes perfect sense. And it's true. Cells are built predominantly from proteins. And so you would think that we must need lots of proteins in order to build big, strong, healthy muscles and la, 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 la. That's how these things get sold to us. But that's only looking at half of the obvious part of the picture. The obvious part of the picture is, yes, all cells are built predominantly from proteins. So everything that I eat is made from cells. So they must be predominantly made of proteins then. Which is true. So if that is true, I don't need to worry about proteins because everything that I eat contains proteins. And that's the underlying reality to it.
And so on that, with that exact example in mind, if you wanted to build up muscle and you were a gym head, would you therefore be better doing an exercise regime workout and following that with berries, fruits, things like that, because they're more easily absorbed proteins for your body?
There's lots of different strategies out there. I would point you to the work of Douglas Graham, who's an Olympic athlete, or was an Olympic athlete, became an Olympic trainer when he decided to turn his career in that direction. And he was Martina Navratilova's dietitian throughout the length of her career. She's a tennis player that some of us will remember because she had the longest career of any tennis player. And he was her dietitian throughout it. And she was mostly raw. She didn't shout about it because it wasn't her ideal. But he has been shouting about it for 40 years. And that's what he advocates. If you want muscles that will ache, and that will sweat a lot, and that will be congested, then you eat dense animal matter, because that's what it does. But there are no great athletes out there that want that. That's just what we're trained to do. They are great athletes despite that. And so if you take that that internal nutritional resistance away, and you feed them what they were designed to be built upon, which, I mean, let's have a look at this, then you often hear it these days that, you know, the idea that you need to eat meat in order to be big and strong. And hang on a minute, all of the big, strong animals on land are vegetarian. That doesn't make any sense. Gorillas don't go out and take down cows in order to be the size that they are. And a cow itself is a huge, great chunk of meat. Doesn't eat meat. That makes no sense at all. So take that one further. None of the animals which are our source, our obvious source of protein foods, none of them eat dense proteins. The cow is eating grass, and yet it's loaded with musculature. So clearly it's not part of our relationship with muscle that you need protein to build it. Okay, so we aren't a cow, you could say. You know, I'm not a cow, I can't eat grass. Yeah, okay, but you are a bloody ape. The apes are 7 to 10 times stronger than human beings, and they eat what? Yeah. Come on!
I totally agree. It's absolutely, but I've thought that, you know, it doesn't really matter that we're not these particular animals, but you can see it. You know, like a horse, for example. A horse is a seriously strong piece of kit.
There you go.
they don't feed that any meat anywhere along the way.
Yeah, but we are quite distant from horses and cows, but we are directly related to these other great apes. We have virtually exactly the same digestive system. That's the beauty of it. If you take out the digestive system of a human being and and lay it on the slab alongside the digestive system of a bonobo chimpanzee, you can't tell the difference at the visual level. They are so similar, and all the same rules apply.
Makes perfect sense.
Now, it's going to really aggravate lots of people. That
just trying to convince people they don't need loads of protein essentially is a challenge of some description, and it's just endemic. It's just part of our culture somehow, somewhere. I mean, you know, large pharma agro business is probably why it's part of our culture in reality, rather than it being anything to do with fact. And well, if we're going to be like a bit more like waxing lyrical about it, you can't really re-advertise or rebrand fruit, can you? You know, banana is a banana is a banana. An apple is an apple is an apple. You can't put it in 17 different kinds of fancy packaging to try and, you know, get one up on your competitor, which it's basically fruit just fell out of fashion. That's how I see it in the modern day. It's like fruit and veg basically just sort of fell out of fashion because they weren't cool, and then everything else went to shit. But
we love our technology, don't we? We love our advancements and our upgrades, and we think we're so bloody fantastic because we're redefining everything all the time. But what we're missing in that is it was most right thousands of years ago. It's been getting more out of sync and more problematic. We still are obsessed with the idea that we're living longer than our ancestors, and we're healthier and we're stronger and more robust, and bullshit. If you look back at all of the lines, you see that we are not. The only reason we're alive at all is because we've got a pharmaceutical industry. Take that away, most people, if not everybody, certainly everybody that I know, would be dead. So the comparison between how long we're living now and how long we were living 1,000 years ago is moot. Because they survived. We wouldn't.
That's right, yeah.
It's just a madness.
Yeah, a nation of asthmatics, basically.
Yeah.
Not to be down on any asthmatic sufferers that might be listening. That's not an intentional dig. The sugary brain.
I'm interested in that because there has... I think I've read your book. So, but for those who haven't read your book, you might need to expand a little bit on your science behind why the brain expanded due to sugar intake. And then after that, I've got like a devil's advocate on that because I'll give you both jumping off points, because there is a school of thought that ketosis is the way to go for running your body in an optimal way. And having a brain that's not, you know, lots of people talk about brain fog. And when they do ketosis, the brain fog clears up. And you're aware of bulletproof coffee?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, MCT oil, medium chain triglycerides and how it fuels the ketones in the cell mitochondria, which makes the brain operate in a better way. And so the story goes on like this. And if you follow it, Dave Asprey is the sort of self-proclaimed body hacker or something like that. I can't remember what his actual claim is, but he was adamant that you should absolutely reduce your amount of sugar intake to X number of grams a day, and that, you know, he was basically just glugging MCT oil and constantly giving himself, you know, what you call like brain octane fuel and things like that. It goes very much against your large brain built for fruit hypothesis. How do you unpack those?
Yeah, where do you want to begin? So the model, as I understand it, is that, and it's supported by all the fossil records are very scant, but all of the ones that I have seen all support this model that I'm about to wheel out, that around 200 million years ago, there were these little squirrely ratty things wandering around on the forest floor. And some of them went up into the trees where they found a particularly rich food source, which is the nuts and seeds, the seeds of the trees. And those trees realized, at whatever level trees realize things, that they could hijack these little creatures, because some of these nuts and seeds aren't being chewed up and digested by these little creatures. They're being deposited in little piles of manure in handy places around the forest. And so the tree starts to take advantage of that, starts to use these creatures as its distribution system. And in order to encourage these little rodents to eat its seeds rather than the seeds of that tree over there, it starts to produce a little package around it that is highly nutritious, very colourful, highly attractive, and will ensure the well-being and health of this little creature, because it wants it. The tree wants to hijack this little creature to deposit its seeds further and further afield. So it wants the creature to live long and be healthy. And this creature starts to consume more and more of these little packages of highly nutritionally dense, fantastic, nutrient-packed food sources. And so over the next 100 million years or so, which is a long time, you get a co-evolution where the tree starts to depend upon the creature to deposit its seeds across the forest. And the creature starts to rely upon the tree to facilitate some of its nutritional needs. And so the plant is producing a package which the creature needs. So one of the ways in which the chemistry of the tree works, because we aren't talking about this creature eating a part of the leaf structure of this tree. We're not talking about eating the part of the bark or a part of the root or a part of the rhizome or any of that. We're talking about a little creature that starts to eat the sex organs of the plant, the parts of the plant that reproduce life. And the chemistry that makes that happen inside a flower is exactly the same chemistry that makes that happen inside a mammal. The chemistry is virtually identical. It's completely overlappable. And so the point is, this creature starts to eat the reproductive system of the trees. And inside a flower, to give you an example, inside a flower, there's an area where the seed will form, where the fertilization occurs. And inside that container, that very delicate genetic crucible in which the seeds will form, that is called an ovary, because it's exactly the same chemical environment as happens inside the mammal. And these creatures are eating these. They're eating the results of that, because once the seed is formed, this little package of very nutrient dense material forms around this and you get a fruit. And a fruit is a milestone. It's a springboard in terms of evolution, because throughout the whole of evolution until this point, a creature has to eat a leaf or a root or a bit of bark or a, you know, some part of the plant. But the plant doesn't want the creature to eat that. the plant is trying to protect itself against being eaten. It doesn't want caterpillars and molds and mildews and deer and monkeys to come along and eat it. And so it's producing all kinds of chemistry to mess with the guts of those creatures. And so for a creature to continue to eat those foods, it has to produce antigens to turn off the poisons that the plant has produced to protect itself. And so then the plant has to produce another poison, and then the animal has to produce another antigen. And you go through this ever complexifying arms race between the immune system of the creature and the protective mechanisms of the plant. But fruit was the first time in the whole of evolution where food was given away for the first time ever. And so suddenly we're in a very different relationship, which this relationship isn't parasitic. It's not competitive. It's cooperative. The plant is deliberately producing nutrients to give away to the creature. And the creature is evolving on those easily absorbed nutrients, designed to be digested. Instead of having to battle through the defenses of the plants, it's being bottle fed this incredible chemical mix from the plants. And some of the chemicals that are coming in on there are the sex hormones of the plant, because when the seed is finished, those hormones that were building the seed migrate to the surface and change the color of the fruit, so that this creature can see. If it's got color vision, incidentally, not many animals have color vision. We evolved it so that we could see the ripe fruit across the canopy to attract us to where the fruit is perfect. And so we eat, as a part of that mix, masses of those flavonoids, they're called. And those flavonoids affect the way our own hormones work, because they look very similar to our hormones. We are changed by that. One of the ways that we're changed by that process is these flavonoids inhibit the way in which the brain is formed. It's there have been many, many, many attempts to understand how the brain grew so extraordinarily fast under such a short amount of time. There's no evidence for why it happened in the genes. The genes just don't contain it, because you don't have to have it written into the genes for these things to occur. We used to think that that's how it worked, but we don't think that anymore. It's not a genetic picture that we're looking at. It's an epigenetic picture. It's how you tell those genes to express in the cells. So the most obvious example is that if you feed a man the right mix of hormones, he'll grow breasts. No change in the genes, just immersing those genes in a different set of sex hormones that will have those genes read in a different way that creates different proteins, that creates different cells, boom, breasts. No change in the genetics. And we know that because of our relationship with the most complex life, actually, the angiosperms, the flowering trees, we were immersing our genes in very, very different sex hormone regimes. And you get changes, you get things shifting, nothing to do with the genetics. And one of the things that is very difficult to describe through this sort of black and white genetic idea is, how did the brain grow so fast? Whereas with this hormone idea, it's very simple to explain, because some of those flavonoids affect the way in which the brain goes through a process called synaptic pruning. So in all mammals, neurons and synapses are being formed all the time. We know about this through neurogenesis. There's all kinds of people trying to hack into this process. And in all mammals, there's also this process of synaptic pruning. So when particular sets of networks are not being used so much anymore, they get pruned away, they get dissolved away by a set of hormones. And that's appropriate in, say, a puppy that's growing up as a puppy and it's achieved lots of puppy behavior that's not going to serve it anymore now that it's not being a puppy anymore. So it needs something to update it. And so these hormones come along and they melt away this puppy behavior circuitry to make space for this new behavioral circuitry, which is be like a dog. Yes, yeah, different set of circuits. And so this happens in all mammals, all happens in the same way. But in human beings, it became disrupted because the flavonoids that we're eating in the fruit that we're receiving was getting in the way of the hormones that synaptically prune the brain. They shrink the brain. And so because these hormones are getting in the way of that process, the brain is not being shrunk every day. It starts to grow a little every day. And that's fine. That's, you know, that's just what's going on in this mammal that's eating lots and lots of fruit. Not a problem. But it's also happening in utero, in the baby that is being bred. And so the flavonoids that the mother is eating start to affect the rate at which the baby's brain starts to grow. It starts to grow a little bit bigger each time. And when it's born, to run a slightly bigger brain, you need more sugars. Sugars are what the brain runs on. And so you need to get more sugars, you need to eat more fruit. That brings in more flavonoids, suppresses more hormones. So the next generation will be less synaptically pruned. So the next generation has a slightly bigger brain. And the next generation has a slightly bigger brain, needs more sugars, brings in more flavonoids, bigger brain, bigger brain, bigger brain, bigger brain. And we get this like tumor of undifferentiated neural tissue running up over the top of the old limbic cortex, running up over into what is now the two frontal cortices, the thing that makes us different from almost all the other animals. And so that gives us, that tells us a couple of things about our evolutionary history. It tells us why we have such a love of sugars, because we have the single biggest sugar hungry object in our heads. Why the most obvious thing that people are struggling with, why the most obvious taste and the most obvious nutrient that people are struggling with is sugars. After that, the second most obvious taste that people are struggling with are fats, because you've got to build this thing. And this thing is built only from the very highest quality fats that are actually quite difficult to find. And that tells us a little bit about why women are likely to become fatter than men, because women are looking for these fats in nature to store them so that they can build a second brain in utero when they need to. So they're more likely to store fats. So it tells us all kinds of little interesting quirks of the human being.
On the building fats, actually, I'd love you to go a little bit deeper, because the omega-3 and arthritis link, when I read it, was just so super, super fascinating. Could you unpack that one for us?
Yeah, well, where do we want to go with that? I feel like I should continue on with the why the brain doesn't run so well.
Let's keep going. And to be honest, it's very fascinating. And there's an argument point there, because
I think probably the three theories that I've heard for the enlarged brain, one would be Terence McKenna's stoned ape theory, which is that we started eating these magic mushrooms and grew our brain, which the psychedelic part of my personality really sticks to.
Do you want me to undermine that one straight away?
Go on, please.
It's very simple. A, he doesn't propose any inheritance mechanism. There's no means by which the next generation would be ahead of the previous generation. Yeah, so you get a big-brained, high psychedelic ape. Yeah, fantastic. But there's no mechanism by which it affects the generation after. So you don't get a bigger brain.
Not even culturally?
Well, you don't get a bigger brain from cultural inversion. You get a bigger brain from being red.
If the bigger brained ones were eating the mushrooms, and then within the tribe, they're like, you must keep eating these mushrooms. But I suppose, yeah.
But there's no mechanism which builds a bigger brain from that.
The other thing
about that, and this is what's true of most of them, if you look back at every single ancient tradition, not one of them says we were once a caveman and we got more and more and more intelligent and more psychedelic. Actually, every single traditional myth says we were once like gods, we were magnificent, completely plugged into everything around us and harmonized with everything, and we started to fall. So for me, as much as I love Terence McKenna, he totally missed the biscuit on that one.
It's a nice story.
It's a lovely story.
And I'd love to go back to the fallen from grace myth or history. Yep. But the other one that people say is the invention of fire. I hear that. That's a sort of common thing that gets quoted
Yeah.
We were able to consume more calories, and we were able to do that because of fire.
Yeah.
And we didn't have to process it so much, which gave us blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, the invention of fire changed the invention. The our capacity to manage fire gave us a lot of changes for obvious reasons. But if we look again at the basic principle behind that is, okay, so when we cooked things, it gave us more calories in our diet. That is not true. It's fundamentally not true. You do not get more calories from cooking things. The tests have been done time and time and time and time again on mice, on rats, on apes. You don't get more calories. It just doesn't happen. But more importantly than that, the other argument that's often cited around it is, oh, it gave us access to more soft proteins because we could suddenly cook meat. What's that got to do with the brain? The brain's not built from proteins. The brain's built from fats. Fats are actively destroyed by heat. It just doesn't stand up. I totally get the idea, but it doesn't. You go from this sort of cultural idea through this little biological bottleneck of, okay, now prove what you've just said, and it doesn't come true. It doesn't work. What we find actually is that if you look at the fossil record, which is very scant, as I said, because you're talking about inside tropical forests, and inside tropical forests everything is recycled. There are no bones kicking around. You only really get fossil records in the deserts, where you don't get much bacterial action, or in the peat bogs, where you don't get much bacterial action. They're the only real places, or in the ice, obviously, where you don't get much bacterial action. In the forest, there's masses, everything's being recycled, there's nothing left over, but occasionally you get a little thing. And the very scant fossil records show very clearly that we were already bipedal. We had already stood up when we were in the forest. We didn't come out of the forests crawling and then stand up in order to hunt and start using fire. That's not how it was. The fossil record is now getting clearer and clearer and clearer and clearer. We had already stood up when we were in the forests. And then about 30,000 years ago, given that we had waves of different bands of humans or humanoids leaving the forest over the past 2 million years, the most recent ones that left the forest were about 100,000 years ago, that we seem to be most closely connected to genetically. And they have not gone through a brain expansion. About 30,000 years ago, so this is 30,000 years ago, not 100,000 years ago, 30,000 years ago, our brain capacity was about 1500 cc. Now it's about 1350. We've lost about 10% of our brain capacity in the past 30,000 years. So who knows how much bigger our brain was back then? We aren't seeing this expansion of brain. We are seeing a descent of brain. It's something that a lot of people don't like to talk about for obvious reasons, because we're supposed to be the top of the heap and all that business.
So let's take one step back, because we were talking about sexy plants with flavonoids programming and making love to our brains and making them bigger, and the brain needing to be built from only the highest quality fats. And then I interrupted you.
There are relatively few sources of those fats and oils, so we can only assume, given that all the great apes managed it, that it was entirely possible for us to build a nice big fatty brain, because they were doing it without much struggle, it seems. We did have to invent a gallbladder, for example, which optimizes the amount of fats that we've got coming in our diet in order to get as many fats as we needed, not only to build the brain, but also to maintain it and all the other systems that run on the body, in the body, on fats. So it does seem to have had some selective pressure upon us. Trying to find enough fats has been a deal. And trying to find enough sugars does look like that eventually became a bit of a deal as well, despite all of this fruit. We are, for example, one of the only animals on the planet that don't produce our own vitamin C. So the brain, along with much of everything else in the body that carries oxygen, is very susceptible to oxidative damage. It needs a lot of antioxidants to make it work, to stop the oxygen destroying it. And we have, along with all the other mammals, we have attempted to build this thing in our heads, this cerebral center in our heads, from very, very oxidizable material that requires a lot of antioxidants to protect it. And so all the other mammals, bar us and two others, have copies of genes that will produce an enzyme that splits sugars into vitamin C. And so the brain and the arterial network is well protected by masses of antioxidants in the body that the body is producing itself. At some point in our evolution, see, probably in that time where we're eating masses of fruit, our body doesn't want to waste sugars producing vitamin C, because we've got loads of vitamin C coming in the fruit that we're eating as well. And so the selective pressure to maximize the amount of sugars in our system to run this incredible thing in our heads meant that we turned off all the copies of the genes that produce this enzyme that waste sugars by producing vitamin C, because we don't need to, because we've got loads of it coming in our diet. Suddenly there's no more of it coming in our diet, because 100,000 years ago we left the forests. And so we've got massive erosion of our entire system through oxidation. We don't have our own vitamin C production systems. And so, incidentally, the other two places in the mammal record where you get creatures that don't produce vitamin C is in fruit bats that seemingly would have gone through the same process that we've gone through, and interestingly have the biggest brain of all the bats for the same flavonoid reasons. And the capybaras, the guinea pig line, probably went through some strong fruit relationship in their history, but it's not so clear with them. So we see this quirk that we've got going on, where we don't produce vitamin C anymore. So we need loads of it from our environment, but we're not getting loads of it from our environment. So the brain is being eroded away by the oxygen that it actually needs. It's going through oxidative stress. It's being eaten away. And so we have a process where the brain is shrinking over the course of our lives. And the left hemisphere, for reasons that we haven't got time for today, but you've read in the book, the left hemisphere is shrinking faster than the right hemisphere. And in men, it's shrinking faster still. So there's going to be all kinds of hacks that will come up in the face of this. There's all kinds of little high octane bottles of things that you can add to your diesel to get your petrol car to go a bit faster. But you're not looking at the fundamental structure of the thing, what it was originally built on. Yes, you can hack it to squeeze a bit more sex out of it. But if you're not looking at what it was designed to work from, then it will fall over. You will blow the gaskets on that machine by just squeezing it harder.
What do you think if you're doing both? What if you're, you know, I've been a fruit advocate for years. It's been what I have it for breakfast every day, and I've done for like 5 years. But if you do that, and then you're using these like hacks as well, you think you're sort of turbocharging the bits that are weak in the brain, or you worst of both worlds? What do you think is going on there?
That's a really interesting question. I guess I can kind of sound like a, I don't know, what would you call that, an anti-haxer? But that's actually not what I'm trying to bring across. What I'm trying to bring across is, if we don't understand the foundations then of how we are built, then we will be trying to squeeze more juice out of it in a way that ultimately destroys it. It's like trying to live a life on amphetamine. Something's going to fall off at some point. Whereas if you support the substructure with how it was built, then you could probably neck all the amphetamine you like, as long as you are supporting the cost. So yeah, maybe these hacks can be very useful.
I think we just told the audience to, as long as they eat as much fruit as they like, they can they can smash amphetamines all day. Definitely not the message we were going for.
It's maybe for another day. There is a huge section in the book about how our diet has left us to be entirely more left brain than right brain, and which, you know, maybe we don't have time to unpack it, but it's a massively interesting look at how, if you look at the food builds your body, And the way the food does build your body, it can affect your brain. Essentially, with an entire planet of people that have got brain disease of one description or another. The super interesting point that I did want to go into was the omega-3 and arthritis, because I think arthritis is something that is prevalent and definitely in most people's parents, and they can look forward to it in their own life if they're not that old yet. Yeah, can you unpack that one for us?
Yeah, it's really kind of, it's for me, this subject points to how when we name a condition, it doesn't tell us how that condition came about. It doesn't actually even tell us what is going on in that condition. It tells us what the symptoms are. It's a categorization of symptom sets. So arthritis tells us, even from the word itis, the addition of itis to a body part, is not the name of a problem. It's the name of a condition. It's the name of an inflamed area. So you need to understand the process of inflammation to understand that. We spend quite a lot of money and time these days as a culture trying to suppress our inflammatory system. The inflammatory system is fundamentally genius, and it works perfectly well in all other mammals. The principle is that if cells become damaged, then they give off a compound that calls the immune system to come and have a look. And if the immune system dictates that these cells will be benefited from more nutrition, from more oxygen, then it will ask for the inflammatory system to dilate the area. So more blood comes through that area, bringing more nutrients, more oxygen, takes away carbon dioxide, takes away dead cells, takes away toxins. It just speeds up the healing of that area. It's genius. But the impact of having more blood flow go through something is that it's got to get bigger. And so it inflames, it gets bigger and hotter. And the mechanism through which this is toggled, whether it's on or off, is a compound called prostaglandin. And prostaglandin has at its heart a very rarefied fat that we can't build. It's a fat called EPA. And that EPA comes from omega-3 in our diet. We don't actually, no mammals contain or use pure omega-3. Only the plant world contains omega-3. When animals get hold of it, they break it down and derive various incredible different fats from it. So DHA is what the brain and the nervous system is built from. GLA, ALA, is all kinds of different structures to these fats that can be derived. One of them is EPA, which sits at the center of the prostaglandin, which is the trigger mechanism for the inflammatory system. So if we don't have sufficient omega-3 in our diet, or we have a problem with processing it in some way, we cannot derive EPA. We can't build it because we don't have the kit to build it. We can only derive it from our diet. If the origins are not in our diet, we don't have enough of it in the system. So the prostaglandin trigger mechanism doesn't get built from this highly rarefied, incredibly powerful oil. It gets built from chip fat because that's what's available. And so that's not going to work so well. So you get an inflammatory system that doesn't switch on when it should do. Doesn't switch off when it should do, switches on and off in between modes. It's just, it's not very good at its job. And so you get inflammation happening in areas where there's no problems to solve, which the immune system hasn't actually asked for the inflammatory system to come on. So you get random inflammations. So we can, in some instances, see this from enclosed or contained diets. So in hospitals and prisons and certain types of schools, you know exactly what your population is eating because you feed them. And so through those kinds of environments, it has been shown that the inclusion of omega-3 in certain forms will massively decrease certain inflammatory conditions. Not because omega-3 solves the problem of a big calcific spur sticking into the cartilage that's wearing away the cartilage and the bone is starting to grind against the bone, and so you've got inflammation, therefore you've got arthritis. It's not going to solve that. but it is going to solve potentially that there is no calciphysic spur, there is no arthritic problem. You've got arthritis, you've got inflammation of that joint because the inflammatory system was just switched on because it was built from chip fat. So if there isn't a problem there except the inflammation, then it will go some way to solve it. This is only a part of the inflammatory picture as well. At the same time, that is, you know, it's an important part to understand. But there's a much bigger part, which is pretty much every inflammatory food are foods that are cooked, are modern diet foods. They're almost all inflammatory foods. Pretty much every anti-inflammatory food are foods that we would have been eating for hundreds of millions of years. So if we were to take away all of these aggressive inflammatory foods that are in the modern diet, just take them all away and flood back into the diet exactly what the ape would have been eating, then you would have been loaded with anti-inflammatories, just swimming in them. Your body would have had a real effort to turn the inflammatory system on, which goes some way to show why it's so bloody trigger happy without all of those in the mix.
Yeah. Don't build your body on chip fat is definitely a big that's more the sort of lesson I was hoping to pull out of the podcast.
It makes perfect sense. It's how you can expect to build a decent structure. I mean, you wouldn't go about building a skyscraper and then get, you know, the weakest metal and the shittest plasterboard with the most jelly foundations. But that's somehow we expect that from our bodies, you know, just, well, not all of you, let's say society somehow expects it's going to be okay. It's a weird thing that happened, and you wrote about it in your book actually as well. And I think this is, I think we need to grow up as a society generally and go back to mostly organic foods and things like that. I mean, I grew up in the 80s, and I'm pretty sure that's when Tesco Value had just released their range. And I'm pretty sure that my parents, God love them, they just didn't do a great job nutritionally. They weren't that aware. They weren't that awake with all that stuff. And they just thought it was great. Oh, wow, awesome. We can feed the whole family for 13p. And it's like, you can feed the whole family for 13p. It doesn't mean necessarily that you should do it. But it's this kind of the problems of mass agriculture, the pesticides that we're spraying straight on the food, and then we're eating the food. It's all these kind of things that everybody knows are really obvious, but we're just not actually going about it. And I have a friend of mine who owns the local, John, if you're listening, hey, who owns the local health food organic shop. And the biggest problem he has, really, is getting people to part with their cash. And I find it very interesting when you look at the problems that, you know, huge agricultural businesses cause, the deforestation, the pesticides on the soil, all that stuff. And everybody goes, oh, it's really bad that we should definitely sort that. You know, we should really do something about that. You know, lots of virtue signaling about it. And then when it comes down to the actual pounds and pence, you're like, people don't shop in his organic food shop that don't use pesticides and are grown from more locally people because they can get twice as much completely nutrient devoid food from somewhere else. And it's kind of, I don't know, for me, it's a, it comes down to the people who like to say these things, but when it comes down to the bottom line of the money in their pocket, they're not actually willing to spend on these things that will fix them. It seems to be like a societal growing up thing we need to do and just pay more for food.
Yeah, it's very much like that. It's one of my favorite phrases that I wheel out every now and then is that the pen used to be mightier than the sword. The penny is now mightier than the pen. That's the only vote that we've got, is where we spend our cash. That's what we're voting for. Forget the fucking ballots, forget virtue signaling, just get out there and put your money where your mouth is. But people don't, do they? Because I guess it's true for a lot of people. Obviously, you know, there is a financial crisis going on in most people's lives. I totally understand it. But even those for whom money is not that big an issue, they're still looking for the cheapest. even though it costs more planets, it costs less money. Come on.
Yeah.
But there we go. I
could understand it from a financial point of view. And just to, you know, there was a point in my life where I was living in London and I was, you know, would worry about the price of a cup of coffee because London's an expensive place to be. And I did all of my weekly shopping at Lidl, you know, the whole lot. And now I wouldn't touch it with a barge pole as the time's gone on. So it's sort of very easy to preach these things and possibly a little bit more difficult. But you're definitely, you know, talking about omega-3 and arthritis or building the brain from the wrong, you know, anything from the wrong fats. It's eventually, if you're getting away with it now, eventually you're going to have a problem. And I sort of, my circle of people that surrounds me tend to be the people that are already on this tick, but it is the minority, you know. That's not the majority. The majority is still stuffing their face with Doritos and getting takeaways and stuff like that. And yeah, but I'm fine. You're like, you're fine now. You know, it's just like, it's all a ticking time bomb. So I would love you if you could quickly, and I'm conscious of your time, not my time, but the unpacking of the fallen from grace. So we've got these delicious brains that sexy plants have grown for us. And we used to be a 1500 capacity brain, not a 1300. And what was the time like in this 1500 capacity brain? We don't know for sure, but I know you have some thoughts on that.
Well, obviously we don't know anything about that time. We can postulate a lot. We can talk a lot about it. The only thing that holds any sway for me are correlations that I find. So every single creation myth says the same thing. Separated by oceans, people separated by unpassable mountain ranges. They all say the same things. They all say we were once like gods. We were completely connected. We virtually lived forever in perfect health. We were completely in sync with the world around us. We had telepathy going on. We had, you know, all of those key magic, la la, Glastonbury, pixies and unicorns kind of thing. They all say that. And all of the paths that come from them, all of the mystical schools that are a kind of inheritance from all of the things that they then wrote down. So they all wrote down creation myths. They didn't write down shopping lists and bitch lists and political lists until thousands and thousands of years later. That's when you started to record kings and wealth and all that, thousands of years later. The first things that were written down were completely esoteric. They were, this is where we come from, and we are falling from grace. And here's a few things that we've noticed that slow that problem down. So things that became paths that we now recognize in the 21st century, things like yoga and qigong and meditation and prayer and song and chanting and gratitude practice, all these kinds of things, they all originate from all of those different paths. All of those different paths practice those things. Those correlations are important. But all of those paths also talk about states that it is possible to get into by using those practices, which look very similar to each other. They all talk about a great unified field around us, in which all these seemingly separate objects are no longer separate. They are all one single object that we are a part of, that I am a part of. There's no difference between me and anything else, which is a nice sort of esoteric-y thing to say. But if you've ever necked enough psychedelics, you will have had that experience come and go. And the point is that all of those ancient practices point to this state with a salutation to having got back to how we were before the fall from grace. And so I would suggest that how it was for us going on those correlations, how it was for us was, imagine to the point of, you know, the point of the limits of our imagination, imagine swinging through a forest that is you, populated by all kinds of other creatures of every other conceivable color, shape, size, smell, touch, all looking out from their portals into this forest, which is you. And all of those creatures that you are looking at the forest through are also you. And you have nothing to do but swing through this bejeweled mystery, eating fruit and having sex. That's what I see. I see when I see a bird of paradise flower, when I see a mantis shrimp, when I see an octopus, when I see a hummingbird, when I see a macaw, I don't see the scratching and the struggling of life competing with itself just to kind of get through evolution. I see 4 billion years of celebration. I see a universe that is conscious in some way that I cannot understand, that has infinity and eternity to play with. What's it going to do? It's going to create. It's going to play. That's what I see. Mm. And I think that this thing in our heads was and possibly could scratch back some shadow of its former self, was tuned to that level where it's just, it's aware of this, yeah, infinite, eternal, unfolding, ever-changing, yet ever-consistent, living, breathing, colourful, mandala-y mystery thing.
Do you think that we can get back to it? I mean, obviously the brain size has shrunk and we can't fix that in a generation, or many, many, many generations, but by feeding it what it was supposed to be living on, do you think we can reverse the synaptic pruning? Do you think we can put these levels of testosterone in our brain down so that we don't have this... Dumbening,
like it.
Or leftening, if you want to call it that.
It would depend who we're talking about. If you're talking about you and me, like you say, there's limited things that we can do. We've already lost three wheels. We can limp along on one for a while. We might be able to jack one, you know, glue some Lego wheels onto the other side and fly along a bit smoother. But the next generation that is still much younger than us, and so much less pruning has gone on, there's much more that can be done there. But the real work would be in those that are as yet unborn, who would come out of mothers that are less damaged. That's where the real work would go on. And if you look at every ancient scripture, again, when you talk about people like, you know, the mythical characters along the way, the Jesuses and the Buddhas and the Muhammads, they were born of very special mothers. They were born of mothers that were already very, very special. They use words like holy and sinful and all that kind of blah, blah. Scrap all of the judgment around it and just look at what's being said. They all came from mothers that were already very elevated. And so, you know, these are the last little trickles down of those were a little less damaged than the general population.
Super interesting. On the subject of this kind of fallen from grace idea as well, and talking about mantra and song and celebration and all these things that would sort of help to keep us less falling from grace. A quote from your own book actually was, "Only one thing about a person's life can be discerned from looking at the brain with the naked eye, whether they played a musical instrument or not."
That's a cracker, isn't it?
Which I thought was super, super interesting. And there was another point you made, which I just encourage people to read your book, basically, because it was massively interesting. But it was the increased word count of languages as we... sort of, you know, essentially as the brain size got smaller and as the left brain started to take over from where the right brain had shared control. And you kind of start with, it was Aramaic, had about 400 words, and then jumps up to Hebrew with 45,000. It goes up this list until you get to Arabic that's got 12 million words in order to try and comprehend this sort of singular process mind. You know, the left brain can only handle one thing at a time. That's why that's why you can drive a car without thinking about it, because obviously the right brain's in control. But yeah, it's almost like it's some sort of, it feels to me like the growth of numbers within the languages is almost an indicative measure of how big the left brain is controlling a society. You know, you say you can't measure these things. That looks like a measurement to me. That looks like a direct measurement where we can say over time words have increased because we understand our being less, you know.
But the beauty of it, the madness of it, is that when you look at that through the lens of the intellect, which is the intellectual world, which is the icon of a damaged left hemisphere, because everything's separate and everything's isolated from everything else and nothing talks to anything else anymore, exactly like a bunch of neurons without synapses between them. When you look at anything like that, they would say, oh, that's proof of evolution, of intellectual evolution, because we've got more and more definitions available, more and more details and more and more details and more and more details, because that mindset cannot see that far more complicated to process than details are connections. If you get context, you don't need details. But as the context-making machine has gone into lower and lower resolution, as more and more synapses are being pruned out, you can only see more and more details. And then you need to name how each detail fits in with each other detail. And so then you get more words. So you end up with this forever shattering picture instead of one big amorphous high-definition vision. It's brilliant. But yeah, I would say that's a pretty damn good and worrying metric myself, yeah.
We would like to pat ourselves on the back probably for that as well. I'm sure there's people at Oxford English Dictionary that love the fact that there's, you know, umpteen million words in the English language, rather than just contextually understanding the world that they're in. So, back to you, Dan. Let's talk about your retreats, because I'm actually interested to know first of all, what kind of problems do people have that they come and seek you out? I want to know about your kind of detox retreat. Talk us through the process. And I know you have lots of views on detox generally, and I've got a couple of spanners to throw at you for you to debunk, let's say.
Sure. Yeah, and it's another huge subject, isn't it? Especially in the past 10 years or so, this word detox can suddenly mean anything. When I started in this 20 odd years ago, detox was a word that was almost entirely associated with alcohol and heroin. And I was constantly battling against that, you know, trying to define people phoning up saying, is that what you do? No, it's not what we do. We do juice fast and la, la, la. But these days, yeah, I mean, you know, Jesus Christ, foot spas can be called a detox. There's, you know, herbal head wraps can be called detox. This has just gone everywhere because it's the nature of marketing. It's the language of language. So what we do is the same thing we've been doing for 25 years, and it's what I was introduced to at the beginning of this story by this book, Health, Sex and Longevity by Daniel Reed. And he's quoting from two or three doctors in the States from 100 years ago, and I'm basically doing the same thing that they're doing, or were doing, still are doing probably, is you just take away the food. It's all you do. The major offending object in most people's lives in terms of their health, their sense of well-being, their mental clarity, their capacity to connect with their emotions, all of that, the main problem is food. We eat such dense, heavy things that there's just no time and no energy and no space in the body to do anything but attempt to digest that. So take that away. So when we started doing this 25 years ago, up until about 5 years ago, we were offering juice fasts, which we do still offer a juice fast. But in the past 5 years, the amount of people that have kind of adjusted to the idea that it's possible to do a water fast has gone off the charts, because water fasting is now in the general atmosphere. It's in the zeitgeist. People...
Gwyneth Paltrow talked about it, so now everybody knows.
Oh, Jesus, right. Well, I was going to quote all the white people in white coats who were going to talk about it, but when you get celebs talking about it, that's it. It's all over, isn't it? So people come to us. They stay with us for a week. There's about 20 people on each retreat. and they're introduced to the process of fasting. So when you fast, the body goes into a particular kind of stasis. So the gut closes down because you've got no additional food coming in. So the peristalsis stops. And so that's fine. The all kinds of things are going to be cycled through the blood, through the immune system jumps online because it's not having to deal with all the junk in the gut anymore. So it can start to clean the blood. The blood is then cleared out by the liver. The liver dumps its debris into the small intestines, and then the blood's clean. And you feel fantastic. The blood's clean. Yay. And then 10 minutes later, one of your tissue structures goes, wow, clean blood. I'm going to make use of that. And it dumps 25 years of debris into your nice clean blood. And you go tail spinning down into a hellhole of, you know, oh, I don't want to be here. Why am I doing this to myself? I feel terrible, irritable, and want to curl up in bed for a couple of days. And da, da, da. And then 10 minutes later, your liver kicks in and clears out all that junk from the blood. And you feel sparkling and fantastic again. And then you feel crap again. And then you feel sparkly again, and then you feel crap again. That's the experience. But people come to us with all manner of different things that they are looking to clear. Mostly these days, it's because they want to experience what a fast is like. So, but not in a voyeuristic way. They know something is wrong. They know that they're 45 and they're pretty sure that their grandmother's got more energy than they have. You know, it's that kind of feeling. I don't know what's wrong. I'm doing everything according to the book. I'm paying my mortgage. I'm paying my taxes. I'm being a really good boy. And yet I feel like crap. And why am I depressed all the bloody time? They don't know what's wrong, but they know something is. And they want to check out fasting because they've heard good things from Michael Bloody Moseley. So they come along and they check it out, and they have a horrible time, and they have a fantastic time, and they have a horrible time, and they have a fantastic time, because that's the nature of the process. And it would be made a lot harder if we just did that kind of fast with them. But we also introduce things like colonics, and we introduce things like bentonite clay and psyllium husks. And the reason that these things are in there is that they're not time tested in the same way that fasting is. Fasting is as old as we've been writing things down. It's one of those things that humanity in separate corners of the world all wrote down as being fantastic for one's health, mental agility, visual acuity, emotional expression, all of it. They all wrote down. It's one of the first tenets that they all wrote down was fasting. So it's going to do that anyway. But if you do it for more than 4 or 5 days, all this junk that's piling into the gut that's not leaving starts to migrate back into the blood. And it's not a problem. It just means you're processing the same stuff again. And when you come to move the gut after 7 days, it's all dark, sticky, icky, foul stuff that the body is never, the gut is never designed to stop. So it doesn't know how to start again. So it can be problematic to start it up. So the colonics and the bentonite and the psyllium and all these other tricks are in there to keep the gut flowing, to make sure that as much debris is actually leaving the body as possible each day rather than just being recycled. Because, you know, at the end of the day, I don't sell any of this stuff as natural. I don't think the colonics as being natural. I don't advocate for colonics outside of fasting. I think it's a really bad idea. I don't advocate fasting unless it's necessary, because I understand no other animal on the planet fasts unless it's sick, unless it's injured, then they all fast. But none of them do it regularly. None of them do it spontaneously. The gut is not designed to do it. So the real question here is, what are we doing in our lives that means that something as stupid and counterintuitive as fasting is better than eating? How have we got ourselves into this pickle where it's such an insane thing is better than eating? And the point with that is, if you can ask that question seriously, if you can go into that question, then you have to come up against the reality that this isn't something that was invented in the 80s. We've been doing this for as long as we've been writing things down. So whatever problem we're trying to solve is that old. So it's big, man. It's big. It's not a little subject.
It is an interesting point that we're the only ones who do fasting voluntarily, just despite the fact that it's a major part of most religions and is now becoming part of the Western religion. Again, probably when you started doing it, people thought you were mad. Imagine they probably thought you were pretty mad when you were out there living a raw food diet 20 years ago. That must have been, everyone was into sausage and chips big time back then. So, and testimonials from doing your retreat. Let's hear, I'm sure you must have some, I cured this, I cured that stories.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really, it's not something that I try to sell it on because it's so individual. Let's look at that arthritis argument, that if we look at someone comes with arthritis and they fast and it cures their arthritis, then the thing that the story starts to be associated with the arthritis. But actually, that's not what happened. What happened was we took away all the offending matter and everything just relaxed. And it's in that relaxation that everything flows better. So, yeah, there's all kinds of things, you know, 18 years of crippling gout that disappear in the first 4 days of fasting. But 3 months later, back on the fags, the beers and the steak, it's got gout again, because the fasting's not the solution. The solution is what changes you make afterwards. So he comes back again the next year, another year's worth of crippling gout. Again, it disappears in 4 days, changes his diet, never happened again. So the point is not the fast. The fast is just, I see it I take advantage of something that happens in the fast, because when you fast and everything relaxes, you become much more consciousness-wise open. You become much more emotionally open. So we have life coaches on the retreat that are in there unpicking things for people, because all kinds of emotions bubble up that now are no longer suppressed with emotion, with food. So all kinds of things come up. And the way that I take advantage of that is I do nutritional talks every day. So what you've read in the book is a big chunk of what gets wheeled out every day for those who want to hear it, to describe how your miraculous body works. And if you understand the ways in which it works and you feed it what it was designed to eat, then it's going to work much better for you. Mm. If you don't, you go back out into the world and do what you were doing before, you'll come back next year with exactly the same symptoms, because there's nothing wrong with the body. It's the fact that you're running your spaceship on diesel. That's the problem. So it's like that. I can jump up and down about all kinds of things that, you know, people that have crawled into the retreat and danced out. There's all kinds of versions of them. But the point is what they do in their lives afterwards. That's the result.
That's the result. I bet you've changed a few lives along the way.
I've caused as many divorces as I have marriages, that's for sure.
Gout's quite an interesting one, actually, because gout sort of goes back to why the body smells and you don't have to wash because of the uric acid. And then it's a very strange one that I still can't get my head around why it builds up in the toe, whether it's just the lowest. It seems, why does it fixate on the toe? It does seem odd, but that's...
I agree. I don't know. I know it's... Well, I get a sense of, you know, it's to do with the uric acid builds up in the muscle structures because it has an affinity for where lactic acid builds up. So you get it in the muscle structures. And if you go down the muscle structure, you've got the muscle structure that's kind of pumping each time the muscle is active. And so that's going to pump these crystals in certain directions. And as you go down the muscle and the muscle becomes thinner and it becomes more of a tendon, that's where a lot of the uric acid is going to build up. And then you get uric acid crystals in the tendon. So then you get crystals in there that aggravate the area around it. So you get it as tendonitis, which is what gout is. It's itis of the tendon, inflammation of the tendon. But why the toe? Yeah, interesting question. Yeah, why not the jaw?
Why not the jaw? It's thanks for the explanation as well. And it seems to be something that's becoming way more prevalent in people who don't necessarily have like what I would consider a bad diet either, and quite healthy and exercise and do stuff. And it's protein rich. You heard it here. Protein rich diets will cause uric acid and you'll get gout. Doesn't matter how healthy you are with that protein. Before we let you go, I'd like to have a few questions. Like, it's a broad question, but in terms of, I know, and again, you can read lots more about it if people will read your book, but sort of either following the hay diet, or if people aren't familiar with that, eat things that are quite similar at the same time and don't throw lots of random things into your body. So eat salad-y leaves with salad-y leaves, eat fruit with fruit, things like that. In terms of just like some easy, quick wins, obviously fasting is a one that you would advocate. In terms of dietary choices, is there any sort of basic quick win that you could provide to people?
Yeah, I mean, I've been wheeling it out for many years as a basic, because when someone signs up for a retreat with us, they get how to prepare for the retreat set of protocols to follow if they want to. It doesn't matter if they do, it's all the same miracles are going to go on, but it makes the adjustment period a bit easier of moving into fasting. And that is basically what I advocate to everybody, is over the course of time, cut out grains and beans and replace them with nuts and seeds and fruit, and especially leaves. So all of the things that we were using to create density in our lives, to create foods that are so dense and filling that we can't eat until our next mealtime, all of the dense stuff that we're using in this, which is grains and beans and meat, get them smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller on the plate until they're not there anymore, and increase and increase and increase the amount of leaves instead. And so you end up with this movement towards a more natural diet. And so plenty of people that come on the retreat with us that got this email a month ago and they started to do it, they've already lost 4 stone by the time they get to us, which, if that was what they were, coming to us for. And they already have so much more energy than they had in the months before. They already have, lost their arthritis, or, their hearings come back, or whatever it is, la, 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 because they are the main players in the problem. So minimizing them, maximizing the amount of leaves in their diet. Don't do it overnight. Do it slowly, slowly, so you don't even notice.
Excellent advice. Out with the grains, out with the beans. What about the hummus? What do we do about the hummus, Dow?
Okay, look up online courgette hummus.
Okay.
Because it's a really good example. Hummus is chickpeas, which nobody sits down and eats a pile of chickpeas because they're bloody boring. Your taste buds are telling you everything you need to know about that already. So put them down and understand what you were doing. You were getting a handful of, or bowl full of chickpeas, and that's not interesting. So slathering it with salt, which is a major taste bud, oil, a major taste bud, spices, which have major taste buds associated with them, grind it all up, and it becomes this yummy thing. So if you were to take away the chickpeas and grate or grind down courgettes and use all those same ingredients on top, so the oil and the salt and the chili and the tahini and all of la, 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 mix it up until it's the same consistency, it's identical. Because the chickpeas actually had nothing to do with the process in the first place. They're just the filler. And when you're using courgette hummus instead of chickpea hummus, you're not going to be farting all day.
My missus will be pleased.
Mine is, yeah.
And then in terms of your journey, interesting books you read along the way or things you'd highly recommend?
The only book that I recommend these days is the book that's on the subject of that final chapter that I wrote about. He's an incredible man that I've been working alongside for 15 years, who knows far more about all those things than I do. And his book is called Return to the Brain of Eden. And that's the more sort of in-depth understanding of why we have got to where we are. There's probably all kinds of other books that I have read along the way that I don't even remember anymore because they're so far back in my history.
It'll be a big step for anybody to take any recommendation. So Return to the Brain of Eden. I shall stick your website in the show notes along with some other things. Anything else you'd like us to add in there?
No, I think you're all good, man.
Dow, it's been awesome. Thank you so much again for your time. Much appreciated. I love your knowledge. I love your humour. And thank you for ruining hummus.
Pleasure, my friend. Pleasure.
Cheers.
Come back for next time for some more.